Okay, so what we're going to do this evening, we're going to start at the very beginning. We're going to talk about the question of God's existence. And I know everybody, you know, likely in this room, they already believe in God's existence. It's not a question, but it's something that you can deepen. And I'd like to help you deepen your understanding. And there's another thing that I'd like to go over before we even begin any of these classes. And that's the question of why do we bother studying at all? Why do we bother studying about our faith? I had a woman in a parish a bunch of years ago, and she wanted to have her child baptized. And I said, you got to come to baptismal prep classes. And she said, classes, always classes in the Catholic Church. Nothing but classes. And she was upset. But, you know, you realize, why do we have classes? I'll tell you why. Because you can't love what you don't know. And what's our aim? What's our aim? The knowledge and the love of God. The Catholic faith is a relationship. It is a relationship with the transcendent living God. And it's analogous to a relationship that you already know. You didn't love another person in your life until you first knew something about them. And in knowing something about them, you loved them more, and loving them more made you want to learn even more. And it's this ongoing, never-ending cycle of knowledge and love building on one another. That's why we study, okay? And there's another thing about the Catholic faith is that when you study it, it clears up misunderstandings. There's a lot of misunderstandings in the Catholic faith. Yeah, I was just talking to a man yesterday, and he was trying to convince me that there was a time in the Catholic faith in which you could purchase forgiveness of sins. And I said, no, there was never a time in which you could buy forgiveness of sins. But boy, are there a lot of misunderstandings out there. Well, when you study, you can clarify those misunderstandings. So it's about clearing up misunderstandings. Knowledge is at the service of love. That's what we're doing, okay? So we're going to start at the very, very beginning. We're going to start about this question here about God's existence. About God's existence. And I want you to think about this. Quite simply, it's the most important question in the whole world. And people don't often stop to think about this because they're so busy going from one thing to the next, doing the next thing. But the most important question in the whole world, here we are. We're on a stage. Did anybody write the play or are we ad-libbing the lines? If God exists, then all meaning takes its relationship in reference to God. If God does not exist, then nothing has any meaning. This is really important that we clarify this. I say here, atheists know this question makes a great big difference. As I said, the atheists of the French Revolution thought God didn't exist. They thought God was a medieval myth. And what we wanted to do was get beyond the medieval myths and get to the business of living and advancing civilization and making great music and great poetry and great art and building great civilizations. Once we move past this medieval shackles of the existence of God, we can finally achieve these things. Well, the person who first raised that question was Jean-Paul Sartre, a famous atheist, a real hard atheist. And he said, why? If God doesn't exist, why are we doing anything? And if God doesn't exist, what is a great civilization? If God doesn't exist, he quotes Fyodor Dostoevsky, if God doesn't exist, everything is permissible. Nothing has any meaning whatsoever. Freud said that it made an enormous difference. Sigmund Freud said that religious faith was a species of insanity. How about that? Sigmund Freud thought that religious belief was a kind of insanity. And I ask you to think about this for a moment. If God doesn't exist, then religious belief is insanity. Raise your hand if you've heard of the movie Harvey the Rabbit. Raise your hand if you've never heard of the movie. Okay. Back in the 50s, 60s, everybody heard of Jimmy Stewart? Yes? It's a Wonderful Life? Okay. Jimmy Stewart, he made a movie back in the 50s or the 60s. It was based on a stage play. It was called Harvey. And it's a story about this man. He talks to a 9-foot rabbit. He consults this rabbit for everything that he does, all of the decisions that he makes, everything that he does. But nobody can see the rabbit except for him. And he always tells people that he's consulting this rabbit. Well, in the end of the movie, you have reason to believe that the rabbit actually exists. But all throughout the movie, they think Jimmy Stewart is crazy. Let me tell you something. If God doesn't exist, we're more crazy than Jimmy Stewart. Because God is a heck of a lot more important than Harvey the Rabbit. Okay? So it's one of the most important questions to ask. And I want to talk to you for the very first thing in raising this. I want to address some of the arguments against God's existence right up front. Okay? And this might shock you as a surprise, but would you believe there's only one argument against God's existence? Only one. Now, if you talk to an atheist, they'll give you many, many reasons why they say God doesn't exist. But if you look at what they say from the perspective of philosophy, okay, you'll come to discover that much of what they say does not have anything to do with God existing or not existing, but rather they're saying that existence of God is not necessary, or it's psychologically harmful, or it is juvenile, immature. But none of those things prove that God exists or doesn't exist. There's only one argument that says that God doesn't exist. And as you can see right here, that is the argument from evil in the world. It is the only proof that there is no God. So let's go over the question of evil, because when people question about God's existence, they always say, if God exists, why would so many horrible things be happening in my life? If God exists, why would so many horrible things be happening in the world? If God exists, why is there school shootings? Why is there Hiroshima? All these things. Okay, so let's talk about this. For the believer, for you and me, evil's a problem. It's a real problem. We have a hard time talking to people about why God exists when they've just had a death in the family. We have a hard time talking about why God exists when a child has committed suicide. It's very, very hard. It's a problem. For the unbeliever, the problem of evil is a proof. It's a proof that God exists. So here's three arguments against God's existence, and they're all from the problem of evil. Here's the first argument, okay? This is all logic now. If one of two opposites is infinite, the other cannot exist. But God means infinite goodness. So if God exists, then his opposite is evil cannot exist. But evil does exist, therefore God does not. That's the argument. Tight logic there. Okay, let's take another argument. If God exists, then he's both totally good and totally powerful. God means a being whose goodness and power are unlimited. If God were all good, he would will only good, not evil. If God were all powerful, he would get everything that he wills. So if God exists, everything would be good. But everything is not good. Therefore, God does not exist. Pretty tight argument. Okay? Here's the third one. If God is all good, he loves us. If he loves us, he wants us to be happy. And if he's all powerful, he gets anything he wants. But we are not happy. Therefore, God lacks goodness or power or both. And if he exists, he's either bad or weak, and that's not God. By the way, there's a subspecies of atheism that exists is called process theology. And this is the idea that God is in some sort of process of becoming great, but he's not quite there yet. You know, he's kind of like a teenage God. He's on his way, but he hasn't quite arrived. We don't believe that, okay? Would you believe that those three arguments were all that I gave you? They're all come from believers. The first comes from Thomas Aquinas. The second comes from St. Augustine. And the third comes from C.S. Lewis. The best arguments against God's existence come from people who believe in God. You know what's interesting? There's a professor up at Boston College. His name is Peter Kraft. You might have heard of him. And he always has his class in the beginning of the year, raise their hands. Who believes in God? Put your hands up. Who doesn't believe in God? Put your hands up. And then he gives them an assignment. Everybody who believes in God has to argue that God doesn't exist. And everybody who doesn't believe in God has to argue that he does. The people who believe in God write the best arguments as to why God doesn't exist. The people who don't believe in God write the lamest arguments as to why God exists. And then he asks them at the end, why is that the case? And the people who don't believe in God say, well, you know, it's like asking me to explain why there's the Easter Bunny. I mean, come on, it's impossible. And he says, you missed the point entirely. It's that the people who believe understand your side, but you do not understand theirs. Always a very good, can you argue the other side of an issue that you claim to be the master of? If you can't argue the other side, you don't really understand their side. Okay? I'm going to very, very briefly solve this. And I could spend a long time solving this. But there are a lot of other things that I want to say that are very interesting this evening. But so far, so good. You all with me? Okay, let me try to solve this for you, since I've raised this question. Let me solve it for you. The problem of evil, solved in 1 minute or less. In an argument, there are only three ways that you can disprove someone's logic. Three ways. Okay. Number one is you use false premises. Number two is you use faulty logic. Number three, you use ambiguous terms. It's the only three ways. Here, let me give you an example. False premises. Okay. I can disprove an argument by false premises. Here's an argument. All priests can fly like Superman. I am a priest, therefore I can fly like Superman. Perfectly logical, except for it has a very false premise. Priests can't fly like Superman. Okay? Here's a second argument. It's with faulty reasoning. Okay? Everyone in Fredericksburg lives in Virginia. I don't live in Fredericksburg, so I must not live in Virginia. Right? It's got a lack of reasoning as you make your way along. Here's the third way that an argument can be false. Ambiguous terms. Okay? Banks are a safe place to put money. Rivers have banks. Therefore, you should put your money in the riverbank. Ambiguous terms. Okay. When you look at these arguments for God's existence, the arguments for evil, they don't have false premises, do they? They also don't have flaws in logic, do they? So if you're trying to talk about why the problem of evil does not disprove God, the way you do it is you talk about ambiguous terms. Now, there's two ambiguous terms. One is God, and one is evil. Okay. In fact, I'll jump right ahead here, and we'll talk about the nature of God. When an atheist talks about God, you might not be aware of this, but often they're talking about, but when they use the word God, they don't mean by God what we mean by God. An atheist will think of God as, well, you ever heard of the flying spaghetti monster? Raise your hand if you've heard of the flying spaghetti monster. Okay, raise your hand if you've never heard of the flying spaghetti monster. You see, you walked in and I was talking about the flying spaghetti monster, and you're thinking this is some kind of crazy class or something like that. But
it's time for dinner.
But the flying spaghetti monster, you know, they'll say, you guys believe in God and I believe in the flying spaghetti monster. And your understanding of God is completely so absurd that you might as well believe in a flying spaghetti monster. They say that God, they think that when we say God, we mean the greatest of all beings in the universe. I'm not going to take a poll, but I dare suspect that I've asked you what you understand when you mean by God, and if I said true or false, God means the greatest being in the whole universe, don't put your hands up, but I bet you a lot of people put their hands up. Yeah, that sounds pretty good to me. God is the greatest being in the whole universe. We don't believe that. Would you believe? Our understanding of God is that he is not a being in the universe, but God, rather, is the very act of existence itself. And what I'm going to get to later in proving God's existence is part of what we mean by God is that the fact that there is something rather than nothing is already a proof that God exists. Okay? Ambiguous terms. One of them is they equivocate on what the word God means. The other thing is they equivocate on what the word evil means. Now, this is very, very long and drawn out, but if evil were the ultimate, last, and definitive word, then atheism would have a point. But what we come to realize is that through God's providence, he brings good out of evil. And the ultimate example of that is the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And so therefore, we see God drawing good out of evil and becoming the victor over evil, and that makes the arguments against God's existence fall apart. Now, as I said, that's extremely concise. I could talk for an hour on that, but effectively, it's equivocation on the meaning of the word God and on the meaning of the word evil that makes the arguments from evil fall apart. Sort of make sense? Okay, we'll scoot right along. Okay, let's talk about what we do mean by God. And the first thing to understand is God is a spirit. By the way, you're a spirit too. You're a spirit and a body as one. You already know you're a body. You can see it. You can weigh it. You can watch it gain weight. You can watch the hairs fall out. You can watch the wrinkles grow. All these things. You already know that you're a body. But you are a spirit and a body as one. Not a spirit trapped in a body. Not a spirit and a body that are separate. but a spirit and a body of it are one. Allow me just to explain and expand. You're wearing glasses. Your glasses are not an integral part of who you are. The proof of that is that if I remove the glasses, you still remain who you are. Your eyeball, however, that is an integral part of who you are. I can't remove the eyeball and you remain who you are. It does violence to you as a being. If I remove your spirit from your body, you're a cadaver. You want to know what a spirit is? Go to the cemetery, or go to the funeral home, look inside the casket and ask yourself, what's missing? And the answer is the person's spirit. Okay? We say God is your spirit in a body. God is just a pure spirit. So what's a spirit? Well, a spirit is that which knows and loves and wills. I could get into some real long discussions here, but we do not believe that if I could concoct the perfect chemical solution and inject it into your brain, that I could make you have courage, or make you have love, or make you have virtue. The part of you that knows, the part of you that loves, the part of you that wills, that's spiritual. And it's who you really are, okay? But God is an infinite spirit. A spirit has no shape, has no size, has no color, has no weight, doesn't occupy space. But the difference between God's spirit and your spirit is that God's spirit is infinite, okay? It is without limit. As I said, God is the very active existence itself. This is what we mean by God. The very active existence itself. Your soul owes its existence to God. We'll get to that more of that in a second. But more than that, God is omnipresent and eternal. What does that mean? Well, where was God before the universe was created? Where was God before when there wasn't any where? Or where was God when there wasn't any when? Where and when have no application to God at all. He's in everything. He's changeless because he's perfect. Can't change. God can't change. So that throws out the idea of the teenage God, the process theology. Think about this. If you're standing on the South Pole, can you get any further south? If you move in any direction, you're going away from south. God is, by definition, the summit of all perfection. Any change would be a change for the worse. Okay? So there's no change in God, ever. Okay? He's omniscient. God doesn't have knowledge. God is knowledge. He's omnipotent. God doesn't have power. God is power. He's omnibenevolent. God doesn't have goodness. God is goodness. So God is the supreme and perfect of goodness, power, and knowledge. And by the way, I'll just throw these little ideas out. Sometimes people, especially in seventh grade, they'll come along and they'll say, can God make a weight so heavy you can't lift it? You ever heard that before? Yeah, who's never heard that before? I don't want to destroy your faith here or anything like that, but you'll find seventh graders asking, can God make a square circle? Can God make a weight so heavy you can't lift it? You know what the answer to that is? Anybody know? The answer is that the phrase, a weight so heavy God can't lift it, is a meaningless conjunction of words. The phrase, a square circle, is a meaningless combination of words. Words don't acquire meaning simply because I prefix them with the words God can. I'll give you a simpler example. Can God squiggle, squabble, squooble? Those sounds have no meaning, right? They don't acquire meaning simply because I prefix them as saying God can. Okay. A weight so heavy, God can't lift it, those words have no meaning. It's a faulty construct in logic put into vocabulary. A square circle, that phrase has no meaning. So that the answer to the question is that the person asking the question doesn't realize that it's an absurd question. That's how you get out of that little conundrum. Okay. Here's what we say we mean by God. All right. Here's what we say we mean by God. And how do you know this God exists? Well, there's two ways you know God exists. Okay. And I say they're cosmological arguments and they're psychological arguments. And here's what that means. Cosmological arguments means you look at the world around you and you find evidence that what I'm talking about really exists. Psychological arguments is that you look inside to your own experience and you find evidence that what I'm talking about really exists. Okay? But another important thing to say is you're talking about God's existence. You can't prove God exists the same way that, you know, you can prove when this building was constructed. There's no silver bullet that perfectly proves God's existence. It just simply doesn't exist. Okay? Can you prove God's existence? Yes and no. You can prove certain things about God with absolute certainty. But all those things are really just a tiny little slice of what we mean when we talk about God. So, can I prove with pure logic that the God we talk about in the Bible perfectly exists? Would you be surprised to know the answer to that is no. I can prove a lot of things that will show that it's entirely reasonable to believe that the God we talk about in the Bible exists, but of all the things God is, the amount of God that we can actually completely prove with logic is a pretty darn small sliver. Okay? But still, the sliver that you can prove is certain. We believe as Catholics that you do not believe in God's existence. You know God's existence. Did you realize that? Do you know that it's an article of our faith that God's existence can be known with certainty from the light of human reason alone? So if I asked you, strictly speaking, do you believe in God? You say, yes, I believe in God. But if I pressed further, you would be truthful in saying, you know, I don't really believe God exists. I know God exists. It's something that upon the application of my reason, I can know with certainty. Now, the amount that we can know with certainty is a pretty darn small sliver of all that God is, but still, it's very convincing. Okay, that's what I'm going to try to do. That's what I'm going to try to do, is to try to help you understand that. And the biggest cosmological argument is from order in the world. And this is very, very simple if you stop and think about it. It's the idea that beauty and order don't come about by chance. If something's ordered, you know something ordered it. One of my favorite examples of this was the Viking lander back in 1976, first time they ever sent a lander to Mars. They're flying the probe over the surface of Mars, and in this region of Mars called the Cydonia region, they go down, they snap a picture, and it looks like a human face. Well, when that picture hit the press, what did people say? Oh, there's life on Mars. Look, there's a face. But think about the reasoning behind that. Why did they say there's life on Mars? Because they saw something ordered and concluded there must be someone who ordered it. So far, so good? If you see SOS on an island, and you're flying overhead in an airplane, you think someone needs help. You don't think that logs washed up on the shore just randomly formed those letters. When you see a lovely painting, the Mona Lisa, whatever it is, you think someone painted it. You don't think a paint factory exploded, right? And the colors went flying onto a canvas, and that just happened by chance. Okay. But for some funny reason, we're so inclined to look at the world around us that's incredibly ordered. It's like when you look at the things in the world around us, it's as though they bear a tag that says designed by superhuman intelligence. And we look at the world around us, and we say, oh, yeah, it just sort of evolved. It just sort of happened. What I would like you to stop and realize is that doesn't make sense. Okay, so let's talk about some of these. This is a couple little examples. From nature, right? Thousands of bats live in one cave. They all take off instantaneously, but they don't run into each other. That's pretty amazing. Honeycomb of a bee. Hexagonal form, six sides, six equal angles. It holds the most possible honey with the least expenditure of wax. That's pretty amazing, right? A car gets 25 miles to the gallon, give or take. Boeing 747 gets 6 gallons to the mile, but there's a bird called the Black Pole Warbler that travels 2,400 miles from Nova Scotia to South America nonstop for 4 days and 4 nights with an estimated fuel efficiency of 720,000 miles per gallon. Amazing. You say, yeah, well, yeah, it just sort of happened by chance. It doesn't make sense, okay? Here's one of my favorite examples. 1979, there was a Smithsonian Institution study across 6 years, studied 93 different bird migrations, okay? Birds had to migrate at least 500 miles. 91 of 93 of the studies that they followed, the birds avoided all bad weather, which implies that the birds made a decision to fly before leaving shore based on what the weather would be like days later and hundreds of miles away. 91 out of 93 times they got it right. That's not chance. There's some kind of design there. And what I'm asking you to consider is what could possibly cause such a design? It's, as I said, it's a sliver of who God is, but it's something that makes you think, wow, whatever it is, it must be greater than the effect. I mean, that's pretty amazing design. We couldn't design that. We don't even know what the weather is more than 5 days out. You know these 15-day weather forecasts? Totally bogus. Nobody knows what the weather is more than 5 days out. It's total guess after that. I got this one little computer program that tells me 25-day weather forecast. complete fiction. Anyway, the life on Earth. Okay, the universe is an enormous incubator calibrated to produce human life. Life could never have evolved if any of the thousands of narrow windows of opportunity had closed. You ever heard of the rare Earth hypothesis? Raise your hand if you've heard of the rare Earth hypothesis. Okay, the rare Earth hypothesis is the idea. It's sort of a contrary to what Carl Sagan would have said. Carl Sagan would have said, you know, there's billions and billions of galaxies out there in the universe, and just by sheer probability, there must be lots of planets like our own. Well, that was 70s astronomy, but in recent years, we've come to realize that the Earth is a really, really rare place. It's highly, highly improbable to the point that they're beginning to actually wonder that it's so improbable that life would ever evolve that we shouldn't even have life right here. It shouldn't even happen once. Okay, just some of these little, the air we breathe is 21% oxygen. If it was 4% less, we couldn't breathe. If it was 4% more, the atmosphere would spontaneously combust. The Earth's spin is 23.5 degrees. 1 degree more in summer or winter would be 100 degrees hotter or colder. Life would be impossible. The Big Bang had been a trillionth of a degree hotter or colder. The carbon molecule, the foundation of all organic life, would never have developed. I mean, it's hundreds and hundreds of these variables. Another one is the fact we have a large moon that affects the tides, which makes for life to be able to grow and to live and to flourish in the seas, which makes the food chains possible. And a large moon also, you know, it's covered with craters. Every last one of those things would have impacted planet Earth if it hadn't landed on the moon. And then they talk about the gas giants out there, you know, Saturn and Neptune and Jupiter. And these things act as great big comet catchers, protecting Earth from all kinds of space junk that would otherwise fly right to us. All these things. And you put all these variables together, and you realize that the probability of this happening by chance is less than 1 billion, one of a billion people winning every single one of a billion lotteries every single day for a billion years. It doesn't take much to realize the game is fixed. The more you learn this, the more you kind of begin to realize that what requires faith is atheism. There's so much argument that this is ordered. It's like designed by superhuman intelligence. Take a look at the brain right now. 100 billion neurons. That's as many as there are stars in the galaxy sitting right now inside your head. 100 billion neurons. They're lined up end to end. They'd stretch 124 million miles, which would circle the Earth 5,000 times. And right now, as you hear me speak, every single synapse in your brain is firing at a rate of 268 miles per hour. It's calculating 100 trillion calculations in a second, which is still 2,000 times faster than the fastest home computer. It does this on 10 watts of power, and 75% of it is water. That's just inside your head. And again, you know, you look at that and you say, well, that just happened by chance. It's designed by superhuman intelligence. And this is where you start to see astronomers, astrophysicists, and cosmologists with a rate of belief in God somewhere up around 90%. Because they know these things. Now, they might not believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You know, they might not believe Jesus Christ is God in the flesh, but they understand this didn't happen by chance. This couldn't have happened by chance. As you get down into the human sciences and psychology and sociology, the belief in God goes down very, very quickly. Okay? And when you start studying history, it goes down even further. When you start studying government, you know, they look around and they say, there's no God. Okay? And the percentage gets down to be very small. But one thing I'd like also to draw your attention to is this. Often, many believers will feel challenged by Darwinian natural selection, and they have no reason to be. They have no reason to be whatsoever. I've had discussions with people, they're very good Christians, and I'll tell them, there's no reason why there can't be Darwinian natural selection and the existence of God. Why can't God work very subtly, almost with a hidden hand, all throughout history, and, you know, help shape the things that occur. But the one thing that's important to understand about Darwinian natural selection is that it doesn't work on anywhere near a scale large enough to explain the stuff that I've talked about. Okay, so let's talk about Darwin for just a moment. Okay, Charles Darwin goes to the Galapagos Islands in the 1830s, and he looks at 9 different kinds of finches. Some have long beaks, some have short beaks. What he discovers is when there's a drought, the only food the finch can eat is locked up inside a dried fruit which fell off the year before. The ones with long beaks can make their way through to eat the fruit. The ones with short beaks die. Who lives? The ones with long beaks. This leads him to talk about natural selection. Okay? Darwin breeded pigeons. He knows you can alter the color. He knows you can alter the size by choosing who mates with whom. Okay, he saw all this in the Galapagos Islands, and he realizes there must be a selection process. It's just the same as he was when he was breeding pigeons. But the truth is, the selection process for things like beak length is nothing at all like what's necessary to make a human cell. Now, up until 50 years ago, you could have been a Darwinian. Y'all still with me? This isn't like, whew, is it? Okay, good. Y'all, you could have been a real good Darwinian and had a solid understanding of cell biology, but our understanding of cell biology in the last 50 years has exploded exponentially. Isn't that correct? Mm-hmm. To the point where now we understand that a cell, one single cell, it has the complexity almost of a city. It's amazing, all these little mechanisms that bring nutrients all throughout the cell. There's like transportation networks inside the cell and little gates that open and close and let things come and go. Darwin never envisioned that. He never imagined that. And so, you know, it works at a certain level. So, for example, if you go to Japan, there's a certain kind of soft-shell crab that you can find when you go fishing. And if you pick up the crab, you look on the back, it looks like it has a samurai warrior on the back of the crab. It almost looks just like a samurai warrior designed on the shell on the back of the crab. So what happens down through the centuries? They go fishing, the Japanese, and they pull up the bucket full of crabs, and they see the ones that have samurais on it, and they think, well, maybe it's the spirit of a deceased ancestor, and they throw it back. The poor crab who doesn't look like a samurai warrior, he ends up on the dinner plate. Which kind of crab survives the long haul? The ones that look like samurai warriors, right? That's natural selection. But when you start talking about some of these cell processes or, you know, some of the things I was describing about the birds and the migratory, you run into something that's called irreducible complexity. Darwin has no answer for what we call irreducible complexity. A mousetrap is an example of something with irreducible complexity. You look at all the parts on a mousetrap. They're all necessary. If one of them's missing, no mousetrap. It doesn't just kind of gradually happen. Either the whole thing gets put together as a mousetrap, or it doesn't work. Okay? It's irreducible complexity. So a bacterial flagellum. On the backside of a bacteria, there's a little outboard motor. It's amazing. A little outboard motor has 32 moving parts in a tiny little bacteria. So whatever it is that's in the back of my throat right now that's causing me to cough, it's amazing in its complexity. And every last one of them has a little tiny outboard motor in it, 32 moving parts. If one of them was missing, the mechanism wouldn't work. It can't be built gradually. Natural selection, good as it is, isn't adequate to describe all of this. And you have to ask, what is? Okay? And I said, it's a sliver of God's existence, the intelligence and the design behind all of this. Okay? Allow me just throw in a couple tiny little extra examples here. Some people would say, well, you know, just if you have enough time and you have enough probability, don't these things kind of take care of themselves? You know, if you gave a million monkeys a million years, and pretend like all the monkeys can live in for a million years, and then you give them a million iPads or computers, and they make their little paws go, wouldn't one of them eventually type out, you know, Hamlet by William Shakespeare, just by pure chance? Would you believe the answer is not only no, but nowhere near yes? There's a mathematical study by a mathematician at Rice University. His name's Michael Denton. He talked about the probability of chance occurrence of random keystrokes producing a three-letter English word. One chance in 30. Make random keystrokes. One in 30 chance of producing a three-letter English word. As the words get longer, the probability gets lower. 12-letter words, the chance are 1 in 10 to the 14th. There's 10 to the 14 minutes in a billion years. The chance of coming up with a 100-letter-long sentence is 1 in 10 to the 130. There's 1 in 10 to the 76 atoms in the known universe. Okay, 1 to the 10 to the 28 inches spans the measure of the known universe. So you end up like mathematically with limits that are utterly improbable. When you start saying, well, you know, if you give enough time and enough probability, well, actually, no. And by the way, we don't have an infinite amount of time. The universe, as best we're able to gather, is about 14 billion years old, which is anything but infinite. It's a lot, but it's not infinite, okay? So it becomes improbable. Okay, so that's design in the world. Here's another one, causality. And this gets back to what I was talking about where, you know, the fact that something is here is evidence that something is causing it to be here. So I was talking with You ever heard of Bishop Robert Barron? Mm-hmm. Who's heard of Bishop Robert Barron? Okay, anyway, he's a kind of a YouTube celebrity bishop. Kind of person a priest would talk to, right? So I was talking with Robert, he was at this conference once. And he was saying that, you know, he argues causality with people that don't believe in God, and they'll say, well, you know, there was some kind of matter there, and then there was a Big Bang, and then it formed into what we have as the known universe. And he goes, what caused the matter to be there? And there's no answer to that. There's no answer to that. So we have a pen here on the table, and this pen had to come from someplace. Where did it come from? It came from a package full of pens. Where did the package full of pens come from? I don't know. It came from Walmart. How did it get to Walmart? Well, it came from the pen company. They brought it to Walmart. Well, how did it get to the pen company? Well, they made it. Somebody somewhere has to be the origin of this pen, or this pen doesn't exist. But this pen does exist, therefore it has an origin. Make sense? So if I have a hook on a chain, and I can't see where the chain ends, and I say, well, why is this chain holding the hook up in the air? Well, because the chain link above it does. And that's being held up by the chain link above that. And that's being held up by the chain link above that. Logically speaking, somewhere there has to be something holding the whole thing up. Or the whole thing doesn't stand up. But the whole thing does stand up, therefore something's holding it up. So when I say, this is one of the mind-bending, this is one of the things that's going to hit you, if it hasn't hit you already, it'll hit you like, you know, you wake up in the middle of the night and it'll suddenly hit you. Or you'll be like taking a shower, it'll suddenly hit you. Where you realize that the fact that there's something at all is proof. Because everything's contingent, right? I mean, this paper is contingent upon the fact that somebody made the paper, and it's contingent upon the fact that I don't throw it away or burn it. Things come into existence, things come out of existence. This building we're in is on its way out of existence. The roof leaks more and more every year. Okay? Things come into existence, things come out of existence. But there must be, because there's something, there must be something that's causing all that existence. We're saying that something is God. He is the one whose existence is his essence. So one of the best arguments for the existence of God is the fact that you are here. The fact that anything is here. The fact that there is such a word as is. The fact that existence is. Okay? Does that sort of make sense? That's causality. That's causality. Something has to cause all this. Okay? Another one. Now this is shifting gears a little bit. This is shifting gears a little bit. But it comes from the world around us. And it's the existence of saints. Now, I'm really shifting gears here because I'm going straight from philosophy now into religion. But, you know, I want you to look at the way people behave in this world. Look at the way people behave for their country. Look at the way that people behave for, their business. People, the way that people behave for their family. And you'll find lots of good behavior. But when you look at a saint, you're finding something highly unusual. You're finding heroic goodness all the time for everybody. And you got to ask what causes that. And they all have one thing in common. They all believed, let's just not even get as specific as saying Jesus, let's say they all believed in God. And they produced such great goodness as a consequence of this. Either they were all the most deluded fools, and it makes as much sense as believing in Harvey the Rabbit, or they were onto something. And when you see their goodness, you realize they were onto something. You heard the story of Maximilian Kolbe? Raise your hand if you've heard the story of Max. Raise your hand if you've never heard the story of Maximilian Kolbe. Okay. Maximilian Kolbe, I'll just repeat the story. He was a prisoner at Auschwitz, 1941. And he was a Catholic priest. And sometime in Auschwitz, a prisoner escaped. No one knows how he escaped because there's double fences and there's double and triple redundancy. Somehow a prisoner escaped from Auschwitz. So what the guards did, you know, the Nazis, they were not known for their compassion. They lined up everybody in the camp. They started counting them off by tens. And every person who was a number 10 was going to be executed as a way of making sure it never happened again. So they start counting off 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. They came to 10. And Maximilian Kolbe was 11. Don't worry. This isn't 1941, okay? Maximilian Kolbe was number 11, and the man counted out as number 10 falls down to his knees and he says, I have to survive. I've got a family, I've got a home, I've got children, I have to survive, please. Maximilian Kolbe, he steps forward and he goes, I'll be number 10 if you'll let him go. Who does that? I didn't even know the guy. Who does that? And that's just one example of one, you know, and he ended up dying in the starvation bunker for a man you didn't even know. It's an example from the world around us that these people who, you talk about Mother Teresa of Calcutta, and she woke up at 4 a.m. every day, and she spent 2 hours in prayer, and then she spent the rest of her life helping people who could never pay her back. And example after example after example, and they all believed in God. Were they all crazy? I don't think so. I can find people who believe in a lot of things that give me bad examples. I can believe people who want their own glory and power, and they give a lot of bad examples. People who want more money, and they give a lot of bad examples. Men who are chasing after drugs, or they're chasing after a skirt, and they give a lot of bad examples. But it's easy to give bad examples. It's very high and rare to give good examples. And with the saints, you find this repeatedly, and they all believed in God. It's an argument that there's a God, okay? And those are cosmological arguments. Now, here's a couple of psychological arguments. And I might not get finished with this, but you can read the rest on your own. Here's my favorite psychological argument. It's the argument from desire. The argument from desire. Now, here's the idea. Here's the idea. Try to think, step back and think about this. For everything you desire, there's a real, tangible thing out there in the universe that fulfills that desire. If you're thirsty, there's such a thing as water. If you're hungry, there's such a thing as food. If you're tired, there's such a thing as rest. Whatever it might be. If there's whatever it is that you desire, the only things for which there are no tangible fulfillments are not natural desires. I should say, for every natural desire, there's a fulfillment of it. There are conditioned desires. If you watch enough commercials as a child, you might desire a Teddy Ruxpin, right? The talking bear from the 80s. But that's not a natural desire. That's a conditioned desire. If you watch enough baseball, you might really want the Nationals to get their chance to win a World Series. But that's not a natural desire. It's a conditioned desire. For every natural desire, there's a real fulfillment of it, except for the fact that everybody discovers that they have this deep inner desire for something more, and nobody ever seems to discover it. C.S. Lewis, he says, all your life there is an unattainable ecstasy has hovered just beyond the grasp of your consciousness. The day is coming when, after death, you will awaken to find that either beyond all hope you have it, or else that it was within your grasp and you've lost it forever. But what is that something other, right? It's interesting. The happier people are, the more they realize that the things that they have don't fulfill them. You get very unhappy people, they live in this perpetual illusion that if they only had this relationship, or if they only had this job, or if they only had $1 million more, then they'd be happy. The world's most widely proven falsehood. Billions and billions and billions of examples of how that never makes people happy, but people still keep thinking it. If I just had more money, then I'd be happy. I always go to teach the religious education students, and I ask them this question, what do you want? And somebody will always say they want $1 million. And I'll say, why not $1,000,001? Why not 2 million? Why not 2 billion? Yeah, 2 billion, 2 trillion! You know, always more and more and more. But when you find people that really do have exceedingly great wealth, great success, whatever it might be, the perfect relationship, the perfect family, they don't say that it's bad. Don't get me wrong. They don't say that it's bad. But these people are the most keenly aware that there's something that they desire that nothing in this world fulfills. Now, everybody has it. Just like everybody has a desire for food and water. There's a natural corresponding fulfillment for everything you desire. Could it be, perhaps, that there is something that really exists that you were made for that is not of this world? That's the argument from desire. Does that kind of make sense? It's something to kind of think about, okay? Ducks want to swim. They were made for water. Lions hate cages because they were born free. The world is very beautiful. Why do we feel like it's such a limitation? Why do we feel like it's a cage? There's a lot of great things in this world. A brand new father sees a brand new newborn in his arms, and he's deeply fulfilled. And it's like a little foretaste of something even greater that's somehow out there just beyond your reach. Like an appetizer for a main course. Now I ask you, does it make sense that after so many appetizers, there's no main course? It doesn't make sense. It's an argument from desire. Does that kind of make sense? This one you kind of think about and mull over, all right? God is not a divine sadist who invites a starving multitude into his restaurant serves up delicious appetizer after delicious appetizer, only at the end to serve up a great big plate full of nothingness. Doesn't make sense. Okay? There's something out there that actually does fulfill you. Here's another thing. Conscience. And I ask you to just think about this. Conscience. Is there anybody who thinks that you shouldn't obey your conscience? Don't we all, no matter what you believe, doesn't everybody agree, oh, you should obey your conscience, yeah? You should obey your conscience. Does anybody respect somebody who disobeys their conscience? Their conscience tells them they should not cheat on taxes, but they cheat on taxes. Their conscience tells them they should not lie to their friend and say they're sick when they're actually healthy. Their conscience, they constantly disobey. Does anybody respect such a person? No. I ask you to think about this. From what authority could there possibly derive this godlike insistence on obedience if there isn't, in fact, some standard that really exists that we're supposed to live up to, something that doesn't come from ourselves? Why is there a conscience if there is not, in fact, a standard of goodness apart from ourselves that really exists that we can know that's the reason why there's a conscience in the first place? You can kill your conscience, by the way. You can disobey it. One of my favorite examples of this is Hermann Göring. Hermann Göring was the head of the Luftwaffe. They brought him to the Nuremberg trials after World War II, and they showed him all the things that had happened in the concentration camps and the dead bodies and the mounds of dead bodies and the starvation and all this. And he turned to his attorney and he says, "What's wrong with that? Believe it or not. Okay? Believe it. You can kill your conscience, okay? Pol Pot, head of the Khmer Rouge, he killed 2 million people. He didn't think he did anything wrong. You can kill your conscience, don't get me wrong, but there's always something in you that says that you should be striving towards a right thing. Now, you can completely skew it, but still, there's always this idea that you should be striving towards what's right, not towards what's wrong. There's one philosopher in history who upended this. You heard of Friedrich Nietzsche? His whole philosophy is based on this idea, why not pursue evil? Why pursue good? Why not pursue evil? Evil be thou my good. Why not steal? Why not kill? Why not cheat? If you don't believe in God, there's really no reason why not. He died insane, by the way. He's babbling. Did you know that? Friedrich Nietzsche died insane. His last words, he's babbled to himself. I'm dead because I'm stupid, and I'm stupid because I'm dead. I'm dead because I'm stupid, and I'm stupid because I'm dead. He had a very inconsistent moral... By the way, John Paul Sartre, another famous atheist, a real hard atheist, a man who was consistent in his atheism. He believed there's no such thing as love, and he believed there's no such thing as any goodness in another person. The only thing that there was sadomasochism and I-it relationships between persons. And it was so ugly that before he died, he converted to the radical Calvinism of his youth. The ugliness of it made him realize it couldn't be true. Anyway, argument from that's kind of a segue into the question of beauty. This is one of these that you either get or you don't get. Okay, beauty reveals God. So I had a friend in college, and he went hiking in Germany. You ever heard of Neuschwanstein Castle? Raise your hand if you've heard of Raise your hand if you've seen the fairy tale castle in Germany that they used to make the Cinderella Castle at Disneyland. Mm-hmm. Raise your hand if you've seen the Cinderella Castle at Disneyland. Okay, it was based on Mad King Ludwig's Neuschwanstein Castle, which is in the Bavarian Alps. And so my friend, he's an atheist. He's hiking in the Bavarian Alps, and there's a rainstorm that falls, and he keeps on hiking up to the observation point where he can overlook the beautiful Bavarian Alps and Neuschwanstein Castle, and the rain ends, and a rainbow busts out amidst the snow-capped peaks of the distant ridge of the Bavarian Alps, and a beam of light streams down and illuminates Neuschwanstein Castle. And he says to me, "It made me believe in God." Either get that or you don't. It's an experience of beauty. By the way, there's three things: goodness, truth, and beauty. We call them the transcendentals of being. To experience beauty by necessity is to get outside of yourself. To experience truth is by necessity to get outside of yourself. To experience goodness is by necessity to get outside of yourself. Getting outside of yourself and experiencing goodness, truth, and beauty is a direct experience of God. A very slim little sliver of God, but nonetheless real. So that you can take a man who doesn't believe in God, put his newborn infant in his arms, and his heart melts. That's the argument from beauty. It's just there. There's many, many things that I could go on and talk about. You can read the last ones on your own. But, you know, I can't prove to you from cosmological arguments and from psychological arguments, for example, the divinity of Christ. I can't do it. But I can give you a lot to think about that makes you realize that it makes more sense to believe in God than it does to disbelieve in God. And that when we say God, we're talking about this being that is all good, all powerful, all knowing, and is the foundational existence upon which every other existence lasts. Now, I said somewhere in this little talk that you can know God exists with just your reason alone. And it's true, you can. You can know that God exists with just your reason alone. However, what you know about God from just your reason alone is full of mistakes and pitfalls. So what we believe as Catholics is that God, who is not an it, but a who, God took the initiative to let us know who he is. We call this initiative divine revelation. We believe that God, who's not a force, who's not just goodness, truth, and beauty, but who's a person, in fact, three persons, that God took an initiative to come to our assistance and help us to understand who he is, revealed who he was. That's divine revelation. That's next week's talk. Okay? That's next week's talk. Divine revelation. What does it mean that God revealed himself to us? And how did God reveal himself to us? And what exactly does that mean? And what does that tell us about him? Okay, so that's next week's talk. What I usually like to do here is I like to end it on time for the sake of everybody who wants to end on time. But before we do, we'll maybe just field a couple of questions if anybody has any questions.